The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, "The Year That Changed Everything." Activists, journalists, artists, and writers on witnessing history, creating change, and being champions for freedom. Organized the power. So many people were moved to do something in the wake of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Protesters activated in droves, feeling like enough is enough. But we surpassed the threshold of injustice a long time ago. We have felt the pain of inequality for centuries. We cannot endure anymore. Human life should not have to be taken for people to notice and speak up about the way Black communities are targets for racism. When it gets to the point where police officers are using Black people for target practice, we are already late to the fight. The resistance against racial inequality and inequity doesn't start after a trigger has been pulled. It starts with our everyday decisions. It starts at the polls. It starts at the school board meetings, at the city council meetings. It starts in conversations with your friends, with the way you raise your children. It starts with who you select on the ballot. In 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. marched on Selma to bring national attention to the issues faced by citizens in the Jim Crow South when they attempted to involve themselves in politics. The march was inspired by the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson, a Black man who was beaten and shot by the police for participating in a peaceful voting rights march. His death was one of many along the road towards suffrage rights. Too often we are sparked to protest after someone has been murdered. We seek justice for the death, but ignore the everyday occurrences that lead to it. Dr. King said it best. We must be concerned about not merely who murdered him, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy that produced the murderer. We must prosecute the shooters, yes, but we must topple the system that empowers the militarized police force in the first place. Voting helps accomplish that. People were beaten, brutalized, terrorized, and murdered for this generation of Black voters to have the right to peacefully engage in politics. There are millions of Black and brown voters in this country who didn't make it a priority to get to the polls. Some didn't have time. Others didn't think their singular ballot would make a difference. Others were afraid of conflict in a tense political and racial climate. None of those is a good excuse, because there is no excuse. People of color, especially Black people, must learn to move within the system, even when we feel like it is rigged against us, because even a rigged system will do what it is designed to do, cause mass destruction if it goes unchecked. We cannot give up when they cheat. Freedom fighters cannot give up when they lie, when they manipulate. We must learn to influence the numbers in concentrated ways to unify our vote in support of candidates who bring us closer to our goals. Although Stacey Abrams, the Black gubernatorial candidate in Georgia's 2018 race, lost the state election for governor, she refused to concede the race. She went on record challenging a system that refused voters their rights. 3 years later, we are all indebted to Stacey Abrams and other courageous Black women like Latasha Brown of Black Voters Matter, Dawana Thompson of Woke Vote, and Helen Butler and Mary Pat Hector of Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda, all whom invested so much to ensure that our voices counted. Georgia hasn't been a blue state since 1992. That is 28 years of tradition in a southern state transformed because activists, celebrities, philanthropists, politicians, and everyday people united. Don't tell me your vote doesn't count. That is no longer an excuse to recuse yourself from the responsibility that the ancestors tasked with you, Black people. The movement is progressive. We may not get everything we want at one time from one candidate, but if we chip away at the goal little by little, the small wins will add up. We don't need a perfect president or governor or school board president or mayor. We need leaders who align with freedom as closely as possible. We need leaders who respect the power of our votes. This is a marathon movement, not a sprint. We must pace ourselves for the journey and make things a little better for each generation that comes after us. The next article within this article is titled, Breonna Taylor Should Be Here. 2020 was the year that put a microscope on the disparities Black people continually grapple with in this country. Black women in particular could not shake the reality that our existence has no value here. Breonna Taylor was one of many lives lost, one more death that symbolized the real fear that Black women have of being robbed of life, liberty, and the ability to reach our full potential. As I followed Breonna Taylor's story and the way her family and supporters had to fight to hold Louisville police accountable for her wrongful death, a lump formed in my throat that wouldn't go away. I held just a tinge of hope that the count of law would do right by Breonna. Yet I remained painfully aware of past efforts to hold police accountable. We all waited for the ruling on September 23rd, 2020. It was a Wednesday. The Kentucky grand jury decided to indict only one of the three Louisville Metro police officers involved in the fatal shooting. Brent Hankinson was charged with three counts of wanton endangerment for shooting into neighboring apartments. None of the three officers faced state charges directly over Taylor's death. The news sent shockwaves through the country. In an anxiety-inducing year, this was the straw that broke me and my fellow Black women. Only months before, Tallahassee activist Oluwatoyin Salu was found dead after going missing. I felt numb, sinking in sadness, unable to work or meet my commitments. Breonna was 2 years younger than I am. Oluwatoyin Salu was not yet 20. Despite this place we exist in being hell-bent on telling and showing us that Black women do not matter, I choose to keep going because of them. Through the strength of our sisterhood, I choose to live. The next article within this article is titled, Justice Poor, Adama Brings BLM to Paris. In the midst of a global pandemic in which thousands of people are dying each day, racism takes no days off. They still find ways to kill us. These were my thoughts when I heard the news of George Floyd's death. Sitting in my Paris apartment, far from the U.S., I felt numb. I wish I would have been surprised. George Floyd's killing resonated strongly in France because it was reminiscent of a death 4 years earlier in Paris. In July 2016, Adama Traoré died in police custody after being pinned down during his arrest. Traoré's sister, Assa, launched the Committee for Justice and Truth for Adama to lobby for justice for her brother. 4 years later, the police were cleared of all wrongdoing. Just 4 days after the death of George Floyd, led by Asa Troy, the French and the Americans alike took to the streets to protest police brutality. During the protest, I felt a sense of unity within the Black community in France that I hadn't experienced before. Previously, I had felt like an outsider here. A year later, the protests continue, though with less frequency, and Asa has yet to get justice for her brother. The promises of racial equity have once more faded away. The Black Instagram squares have been deleted, and the diversity panels have slowed. Yet, I will never forget the sense of unity and purpose. I wish the world felt the same way. The next article in this article is titled, When a Black Woman Won the White House. It's a real honor to be a part of history like that. To witness this country on the cusp of something as historic as the election of the first woman vice president, the first Black and South Asian woman to become vice president, obviously you never know in elections what's going to happen. There was a real air of uncertainty, especially after the year we had. There were real questions about whether this country had made enough progress on race to vote Kamala Harris in. I had covered her as a candidate in the Democratic primary. For Black reporters in the political space, there are not nearly enough of us. I had seen the way in which women candidates, and especially Black women candidates, are still treated differently. It really cast a shadow over whether the country was ready to actually make history. Going into election night, like a lot of women in America, I just wasn't sure what the outcome would be. But we did it. We managed to elect a historic vice president, though it certainly took a few days. In my professional life as a journalist, I can recall maybe a handful of moments where I was really witnessing durable history being made in this country, something generations of people will remember for a long time. The election of Kamala Harris was one of those moments in my career. It was really important, not just for the U.S., but to be able to be a part of that and to speak for a lot of people in this country in that moment was a really special thing for me. The next article is titled, Clint Smith Wants a Better Future for His Children and Yours Too. Clint Smith didn't watch last summer's viral video of slain Minnesota resident George Floyd, whose death at the hands of the city's police propelled national and global mass protests, calling for an end to police brutality against Black people. I still haven't watched it, says the author, poet and scholar of the devastating video. I think I had watched all of them before this. I was like, I don't need to see it. I've seen enough. Smith, whose debut nonfiction book, How the Word is Passed, explores our reckoning, or lack thereof, with the country's historical sites and their relationship to slavery, does believe the video documentation of Floyd's death was partially responsible for reinvigorating the nation's race consciousness. But he thinks an amalgamation of other events should also be credited, the country having developed a more complex understanding of racism, the Black Lives Matter movement altering how we think of over-policing, and the pandemic. Having completed his PhD at home via Zoom last year, and in a period when he and his wife have managed without child care for their two children, Smith continued to examine deeply the political future he wants to see, not just as a scholar, but as a parent. I want my children to live a life in which they get to choose to do things that bring them joy, he says, but also wants his children to feel a responsibility for building a better world and for them not to believe the lie that communities that have less are less. When you are clear about that, it's emancipatory because the country can't lie to you anymore, he says. It's why he wants not only his children, but all children to internalize this essential truth so that they will be able to view the world through this liberated lens and know it as their own. The next article in this article is titled, I'ma Keep It Black, But I'ma Keep It Brief. I was a teacher for 2 years, but I realized teaching inside four walls wasn't the best fit for me. I'm a very innovative thinker. I have performance background. What I didn't have experience in was comedy. I found it so interesting when people would describe the work I do in parking lot pimping as funny, because really, I'm just giving facts about Black history. Last January, I had decided to take my work as an edutainer, spelled EDU/TAINR, as an edutainer more seriously and really dive deep into it. And it just so happened that the world decided that the virulent racism was a thing at the same time I was ready to start doing visuals with my poetry. My episode on the Capitol insurrection, which went viral, is what got people interested in the other things that I had to say. I've always seen myself as an activist. My goal in life has always been to share what I know about Black people, because I know we are the best thing since sliced bread. However, in classrooms where I would have to sit and learn about Black history, we would be represented on 28 days out of 365. And that was true from kindergarten to 12th grade, as if to say that we barely made any contributions to American history that mattered, when that's simply not true. I just wanted to share that knowledge. It has been said, if you want to hide something from a Black person, put it in a book. I just want to open the book. That is the activism for me. It is in what I create, and it's not just political commentary. It is not just social commentary. It is protest art. And it's protesting the fact that you don't want us to know these things. Because if you can keep us from knowing these things, then you won't have to deal with us. If we don't know these people existed, who did all of these things before we ever came along, we will think it is that much harder to get something done. You have no guide for how to get it done. So, I just want Black people to know all they are capable of so they can access all of their magic. The next article in this article is titled, My Big Mouth. I'll never forget a day in high school when I was riding on the train with my girlfriends. An older woman stepped on a few stops before the red line separated the north side from the south side of Chicago. She glared at us and demanded, "Why do you have to be so loud?" I was shocked because I had never been told to tone it down. My mom had acknowledged very early on that I was going to be nothing less than a loud woman. She allowed me to own that, and she put me in an environment where it was okay to express myself. This brings me to that fateful day during the civil unrest of 2020, when I stood on a corner in Atlanta and opened my big mouth. I wanted to make it clear that the rules everyone else gets to play by rarely apply to Black people in America. It was completely organic and a direct response to people I was interviewing on the street for a documentary I am making. I should point out that they were mostly African American people who were cleaning up destroyed property. When they expressed concern about how the damage would affect the narrative of the movement, all I heard was, "I am here out of fear of white gaze." The videographer turned on the camera and the ancestors took over my body. After my video, "How Can We Win?" went viral, many people said they couldn't get past how powerfully I had delivered my message. They could not wrap their minds around the notion that hood girls can be heroes too. There's still something intimidating about Black women who don't code switch, the ones who are unapologetically rooted in hip-hop culture. To clarify, the way we speak is cultural, not remedial. The question should never be whether loud women like me deserve a voice in the world, because obviously we do. This is why I am proud to be the voice of the voiceless. The next article is titled Yvonne Orjai. "Becoming a comedian and an actress was not the path this Nigerian American or her parents thought her life would take." In this excerpt from her hilarious new book, Bamboozled by Jesus, she explains how she let go and let God. "Who I am is a concept I've struggled with for a long time. When I was young, I became so many things to so many people at the expense of being myself, all for the sake of fitting in. In school, I became the smart kid because you couldn't be both foolish and friendless. I relished being smart because for those brief moments in science class when I let the pretty girls copy my homework, I believed I was one of them. No matter how fleeting the moment was, I felt needed, necessary, important. At home, I was expected to be the good Nigerian girl. That basically meant make straight A's, go to church, learn to cook, wash dishes, don't date, graduate from college, head to medical school, and somehow suddenly discover the existence of boys, get married, and have 2 to 4 kids, all by the age of 28. This, to my parents and to Nigerian culture at large, was my reasonable service for the sacrifices they had made in bringing my 3 older brothers and me to America. At 6 years old, this was the burden that was placed on me, disguised as duty and destiny. As a kid, I was following the good Nigerian girl protocol to the T, especially when it came to education. That was my parents' top priority. I used to think we were poor the way they shut down my siblings and my request for frivolous things that required money, like recreation and fun. But somehow all of us Orjai kids managed to attend private boarding high schools. I remember once getting a B on my report card and hiding out in the woods by our house for hours, too afraid to go home and reveal the shame I had brought on our family name. There's no denying I was a people pleaser, and by people, I mean my parents. Back then, most of my decision-making came down to this simple criteria. A, would it make mom and dad mad? B, would mom and dad be proud of it or me? C, how bad of a whooping would this get me? Option B was the only thing I lived for. Becoming a doctor would have been the ultimate personification of the American dream for my folks. A lot of people ask why African parents, especially Nigerians, harp on their kids being doctors, lawyers, or engineers. The short answer is bragging rights. Nothing brings Nigerian parents more joy than having a conversation like this in accent. Mom, my dear, how are you? Friend, you know my arthritis is acting up, but other than that, I am fine. How are the children? Mom, oh, they are all well. In fact, join me in thanking God for his goodness and mercy. Justina got admission into Harvard Medical School. Friend, you don't mean it. Wow, God has really blessed you with a child who will care for you in your old age. Mom, amen. Oh, I'm so grateful. It's very unfortunate how your own children turned out. But don't worry, I'll be praying for you. Because bragging always tastes better with a tall glass of shade. Y'all, I tried. I really did. But I am convinced organic chemistry is an enemy of progress. When I saw the F on my transcript and it wasn't for fantastic, I was shook. It meant that I wouldn't be getting into the early acceptance program, a fast-track plan to med school offered at GWU. Maybe I'd known medicine wasn't for me all along. Nothing about being a doctor was remotely appealing to me other than actually being called a doctor, and even that was problematic. Imagine hearing this over the hospital intercom. Paging Dr. Orjai. Dr. Orjai to gynecology. Listen, I'd already been picked on as a kid. I wasn't about to voluntarily carry that into adulthood. On top of my suspect surname, I hate the sight of blood. It's really quite remarkable how I make it through a menstrual cycle each month. Seriously, every 28 days, I'm like, this again? How many eggs am I dropping? Jeez. Uncertain of which path to take, I found it easier to keep dodging the truth rather than let my parents down. Also, I had zero backup plan. How would that conversation even go? Hey, Mom and Dad, I know for the last 21 years, you thought I was going to be this one thing. But yeah, that's not going to work for me anymore. No idea what I'll do instead, but I just know it's not going to be that. Good chat. Have you met Nigerian parents? They would have had my tail on a one-way ticket back to Lagos. So I thugged it out and did the only logical thing to do, stall. And I kept stalling. After a master's in public health and 6 months in Liberia doing developmental work, I returned to Maryland at the height of the 2009 recession and discovered that nobody else had a job. While everyone else seemed devastated by it, the recession was literally the best thing to ever happen to me. If no one else had a job and everyone was struggling to make ends meet, then no one would think it's strange that a dual degree having Nigerian American girl would trade a life in corporate America to become a soon to be starving artist. It was the perfect decoy. Armed with that kind of ammunition, I decided to bet on black and bought a one-way bus ticket to New York City. That meant that I finally had to confess to my parents that their dream would indefinitely be deferred, like a Langston Hughes poem. I explained that I had prayed about it and truly believed this was the path God wanted me to follow. To which my dad angrily retorted, God, you think you are the only one that prays to God? Before you were born, were we not also praying to him? Dang, I couldn't even play the God card. I suggested an ultimatum where they would allow me 8 years to make it as a stand-up, which is roughly the length of time it takes to finish med school and residency. If things didn't work out, then I agreed to come back home, find any job, and marry a Nigerian doctor. Thankfully, I made it in 7 years. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.